toxic cultures are tolerated by the top, and the leadership has the ability to change that. Tell people, listen, if you're living for 5 o'clock, weekends or vacations, then you've pretty much given the whole rest of your life away. So you begin this like, I got to change my attitude about when something doesn't go my way, what am I being saved from?
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple, to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside. Today, we are meeting with Dr. Keith Linkscale. He's a recognized Lean Six Sigma black belt and operational excellence executive known for best-in-class strategic performance management programs. He demonstrates a combination of broad industry experiences, performance management acumen, and a history of results-oriented management consulting to drive significant improvement and cost saving. Keith, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Keith. I guess it's the Keith and Keith show. I take it.
We'll call this the Keith show, the K2, Keith squared or something.
There you go. Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really excited about being here.
Absolutely. Well, Keith and I met a few years ago at the BTOS conference in Orlando. And you are, I don't know if you're from Florida. I think you're from maybe the Northeast, but certainly Boston. Live in Florida. From Boston. Okay. And how do you like Florida versus Boston in the wintertime?
Well, I left Youngstown, Ohio at 18 years old, and I went to Boston to go to Boston University. And once I graduated, I met my wife there, and then we stayed there for 24 years. And then we took all of our family started, visiting Florida and moving to Florida. It's like, okay, there was a break in my career. It's like, let's just pack up and move to Florida. And so I've been here since, 21 years now, since 2004. I tell you, I love Boston, but I don't miss the winters. I don't miss the raking the leaves. I don't miss trying to dig your car out. I love Florida. I mean, this weather, the beach is free, Keith, and the sun is free, and the palm trees are free. So I love it.
I love it. Well, Keith, one of the things we like to start this podcast with is a little segment we call The Spark. And what I find is a lot of folks that I meet that are involved in this continuous improvement, there was a point in time, maybe a certain thing that happened in your life, a moment where something kind of switched on and you decided, you know what, this thing, continuous improvement, however you pursue it, is something of interest. Do you recall when that spark was first lit up for you?
Well, you know what? It's interesting. I fell into this and it was sort of like ordained because I studied electrical engineering at Boston University. And the first job I got was a company called Digital Equipment Corporation. We call it DEC or DEC. They were the second largest computer company to IBM, and they were headquartered in Maynard, Massachusetts. They hired me as a quality engineer. And so I didn't exactly know what that was. I was an electrical engineer by degree, but it taught me process. It taught me quality. I started studying dimming and all of that. And then I was hired into the external products group. And so what that was that allowed me to go to the different partners of Digital and audit them on their processes. So it just all fell in. I'm like, processes and then process improvement. And then I got trained in Six Sigma back, Motorola Six Sigma. It didn't have the lean component on it. But I started learning all the pieces of quality improvement. I remember taking a very first course called Basic Problem Solving Techniques. And it taught me the fishbone diagram. It taught me how to find the root cause. And it just clicked. I mean, I moved from quality engineer one to quality engineer two to senior quality engineer to principal quality engineer. And then just for that one company, 8 years with that one company. And then I wrote a couple articles And before I know it, a management consulting company was tapping me on the shoulder saying, we want you to come do that for multiple clients in multiple industries. And now I was just in a row.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about your journey. I mean, you started out in electrical engineering as a quality manager, and now you're working at Palm Beach County. Tell us about some of the milestones along the way where this journey into continuous improvement evolved for you.
Well, it's funny because when I started with the management consulting firm, one of the products that we developed, we called the Lego Workshop. And it was a Lego workshop that demonstrated the before and after of a push versus a pull system. And I remember teaching that. I developed it and taught it. I was called to the MIT School of Management to actually take their students through this simulation. And then I got clients where we went into a manufacturing floor and we showed them how to re-engineer the manufacturing floor, move from a push environment to a pull environment. And it included Kanban, just-in-time, inventory at the source, reducing inspection, reducing rework, all of that. And so that just started clicking and clicking. So I sort of developed this toolkit. And so I ended up doing management consulting for about 15 years, helping companies streamline processes, put in metrics, use the process improvement. Fast forward, I remember to the point where now I'm a partner, associate partner at a management consulting firm. And when 9/11 hit in consulting, all clients stopped and all travel stopped. So I took that as an opportunity to, you know what, take a severance package and move to Florida with the family. Got here in Florida and said, you know what, not a whole lot of industry here. And so I stumbled into the public sector where I'm now at. And it's so interesting trying to apply all those concepts to legacy process and systems within a public sector. Big challenge. And that sort of leads me to my role as Director of Strategic Planning and Performance Management. When I say performance management for the county, I expand my role to say performance improvement, performance reporting, and performance management. So it's all operational excellence. But here's the thing, Keith. This is where it has taken me. What I did not learn in my early ages. I always thought it's about the process or the systems or the tools that you actually implement. Lean Six Sigma, put in the ERP system, re-engineering the process. But here's the thing, when I got to the county, and I don't know if I would have seen this in the private industry, I saw that Peter Drucker's statement, culture will eat strategy for breakfast. A light bulb went off. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I've never really taken in the people component. See, think about it this way. With KPI Fire, when we go to these conferences, we see tons of solutions. We see a lot of software solutions. We see a lot of buzzwords, the new buzzwords, OKR, Scrum, just-in-time, Lean Six Sigma. These are all tools in our toolkit. But here's the thing. What if you're trying to implement that, any of those, in a toxic environment? Or a place where people don't feel valued, or a place where we've always done it this way, or a place where, like in a county, people started when they were 18, 19, 20, 21, and they're still here 20, 30, 40 years later. And this is all they know. So now when I go to speak at conferences, and it's interesting that the last two conferences I've spoken at, I'm the only one from government, and I'm the keynote. I went from a workshop to now being a keynote. And you know why? They are experiencing it in the private industry, especially after the pandemic, that culture matters. People matter. So it doesn't matter what tool. We can try all these types of tools. Reason why a lot of organizations do not have sustainable change is because they haven't built it into the culture. They haven't changed the people. They haven't changed the people's mindset. If that makes sense.
Excellent. Absolutely. There's a lot of good stuff I want to drill into. Let's go back to the consulting for just a minute. You mentioned this thing called the Lego Workshop, and this is something that I've seen and heard about versions of this. I wonder if you might just give us an overview of what that Lego Workshop is and kind of the lessons that it is designed to teach.
Okay. So the Lego Workshop is, you have to imagine, you know, it won't resonate with you unless you've actually seen a manufacturing floor, where they're producing objects. So you got to imagine that there's an assembly going on. There's inventory going on. There's inventory being brought from the warehouse to manufacturing line. There's people inspecting. There's rework. All the intricate mechanisms of manufacturing, right? So we take that and we put it in a Lego workshop that says, okay, we're going to simulate that entire manufacturing process. And we simulate it through a push system, which is mainly traditionally most manufacturing started off by pushing. In other words, I'm in my area of the assembly line and I'm just developing. I'm just making my part and I'm pushing it to the next. I'm making my part and pushing it to the next. Not really caring about the ones who's coming before me or the ones who I'm giving it to. So I'm doing my job. I may produce 100, but the next person in the line can only handle 20.
So in this Lego workshop, I'm kind of picturing like different workstations, like an assembly line, and you've got exactly. Maybe like some sub-assembly. Somebody's putting like, I don't know, wheels on a block and somebody
there
else.
There you go.
But you're probably getting like some stations where they're able to work really fast and some stations where it takes longer.
Yes, it's not synchronized. I'm producing, you know, and I'm thinking I'm doing a great job because my power is going like this. But that power has to go to the next person in assembly line. And their station takes longer. What they're putting together takes longer. So now you got all this tons of inventory. And then when the bell rings and people go home and that shift changes or you close for the night, you got this ton of inventory. Now, what happens is it gets dusty. It may get knocked over. Somebody may touch it. You have opportunity for error. So when you push it, you're not really thinking about the next person in the supply chain. But when you pull it, I've done this. I'm passing it on. I need another one from you. Done. Here's the thing, though. I was recently asked, what's one of the major lessons I learned about process improvement that where I screwed up? This is where, as a young consultant, we went and did this for AT&T manufacturing floor in Chicago. I'll never forget it. The process, we did the whole simulation. Then we used their workers, their assembly workers, to do it. This is where the people concern comes in. Because as a young set of consultants, I thought we did an excellent job because we showed how the first process produced rejects and inventory and you name it. The new process, the pull process, we eliminated 1/3 of the people because it was so efficient. And so we said, okay, you guys just sit over there. As a young consultant, naively, I had not thought about what are we going to do with those 30 people. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So when you, here's the thing about process improvement. If you're doing it correctly, and it's the same thing with AI, if you're doing it correctly, you're going to eliminate some non-value-added work.
Yeah, you're going to create some excess capacity.
You're going to create excess capacity. And if you haven't thought that through, okay, I'm going to retrain. We're going to put them in value-added positions. We're going to have them do different types of, you know what I mean? Then you have basically demoralized your entire workforce.
I think that's an interesting concept right there that you can have, let's say, two people in the same scenario. You, maybe as a young consultant, you come in and you're excited about this change and this efficiency that you're creating. And, you know, you're looking at it through one lens. But on the other side, you know, I'm kind of picturing these people that are part of the simulation where you just said, hey, we don't need you anymore. Go sit on the bench.
Right.
And they're like, this change doesn't seem really great. Now I don't, not only do I not feel useful at work, I'm afraid they're going to let me go because that's what happens a lot of times, right? And that's where I think lean particularly gets a bad name.
It's a bad name.
Come in and just use it as a tool to cut. But so take us through that lesson of the, you know, kind of the core lesson that teaches. It sounds like it's about pull.
It's about pull in that situation, but I'll translate it into here at the county. My role as head of performance management and strategic planning was created. I am the first inaugural director of strategic planning and performance management. I was brought on to help the county, the 40 different departments, make decisions based off of data. Now, when you get the data, I have to establish KPIs for every single department. I had to establish scorecards for every single department. Here's the problem. If people think that it's punitive, that they're going to get in trouble, or that they are going to be looked at as incapable because of their metrics, you're not going to get buy-in. And the same with, you know, dissimulation. If those folks feel like they're going to be displaced, they're not going to totally buy into the solution that you're putting in place. So the people aspect is extremely important. So I've had to do a ton, and how do you get past it? I have to do a ton and ton of education and training and why KPIs are important and why key performance indicators will help us do a better job. And being in the red does not always mean bad. It means that you may need more resources. So let me help you justify getting more resources or more call center reps or what have you based on the metrics, based off of the data. So it's creating a new type of message. And it's all, believe me, it's all culture. That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, Your Attitude is Your Breakthrough. And it's on Amazon because I said, okay, if I can change people's attitude or how they think about things, how they approach a situation, then I can change their performance. And then ultimately, their metrics will change. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let me stick with this storyline a little bit. So you came from the private sector business side of things. You moved to Florida, and then you had this opportunity with Palm Beach County or the public sector. Talk for us a little bit, maybe tell us how that opportunity came to be. And then what are some of the differences that you noted in how like a public, a county government type organization is run versus how a business is run? And what did you have to shift your thinking on?
Okay. So here's the thing. When I moved to, so you got to say, I walked away from a high powered associate partner job as a management consulting firm, because after 9/11, the clientele wasn't there. So I took a buyout package. I moved down to Florida and I was overqualified for everything. If you worked up north and now you come down south, you come to Florida, it's a different world. And in Florida, we didn't have a whole, I came from Boston. There's tons of industry, computer, telecom. I worked in the chemical industry, the pharmaceutical industry. I came down here. We had Royal Caribbean. We had Pepsi as the big ones, you know, and Office Depot. So I did get a landed job as a senior procurement manager for Office Depot. Then we went through the recession during 2008. So I then had to look again. And so I went temping. I signed on with a temp agency and they placed me in PalmTran, which is the county's transit agency. Now I started as a temp, as a dispatcher. So you got to imagine, I say six figures down to $11 an hour. Wow. As a dispatcher. But my mindset, that's why I wrote that book on attitude. Yeah, my attitude was still that I'm an engineer. I'm a process improvement guru. I'm an operational excellence guru. So when the executive director came around to meet everybody, you know, I'm there, you know, I tell people I'm still in, you know, white shirt with cufflinks and suspenders. You know, the other dispatchers were like, who is this guy? So, but the executive director, his eyes broke, and he's like, who is this guy? And so I just, come and said, by the way, sir, I'm an engineer, operational excellence. If you ever have a position available, you know, boom, boom, boom. Fast forward, the inspector general told PalmTran that they need to hire a head of performance management that would bring integrity, and performance management and unbiased reporting of their transit system. The requisition came out and I applied for it. And you got to imagine, I'm dispatcher down here. I applied for it. And every transit professional that this executive director knew applied for it. And I won it. I used every bit of learning from the Lego workshop to quality engineering, to operational excellence, to scorecards. I knew everything from, Keith, I knew total quality management, plan, do, check that. Ken Blanchard's balanced scorecard. I knew Michael Hammer's re-engineering, process re-engineering. I was an ISO 9000 auditor. I knew every, what they call flavor of the month in terms of quality. Total quality, you name it.
All the recipes.
So, high-performance teams. So I used the model of high-performance teams in my presentation. I said, we're going to break down silos and create cross-divisional or cross-department teams to solve the problems associated with the metrics. You know, you see what I'm saying? So I got it. Fast forward 15 months later. Now I'm doing this for one of the 40 departments in Palm Beach County. The head of the entire county, the county administrator, said, what in the world is going on over there? She took that job rec and created one for the entire county. And guess who applied for it?
Yes, and it was you.
So now I'm meeting with her and I apply for it and I get hired to do the same thing for 30-40 departments, 150 directors, 1,000 employees, 1.5 million residents, 7 commissioners, 4 assistant county administrators. How do I create a vision, mission, goals, objectives, performance measures, scorecards? I had a complete blank canvas. The rest is history.
And that's where it all started.
That's where it all started. And I'll end with this part. You know, after you get the mechanics done in terms of putting in KPI fire or get in metrics and scorecards and vision, mission, goals, objectives, here's the thing that people, this is where people are failing. What are you doing for the people? What if they're just pissed off, that they feel overworked? They feel like they don't matter. They feel like they have a toxic leader. They have a toxic environment. And see, here's the thing about the county. So many of the leaders were great individual contributors, and they became a supervisor, and they became a manager, and they became a department head with no people skills. Simon Sinek says, quit calling them soft skills like we did in the back in the day. They're not soft. There's nothing soft about them. It's human skills. And if you do not have them in 2025, you will never be able to sustain operational excellence.
I like that. What are, there's so many good things there. We're going to have to jump around a little bit. When you went from the private to the public sector, what was the attitude difference? Or what was like, there was there a mindset difference? I mean, you kind of landed in on this idea of attitude, but I'm wondering if you felt like there was a different, you used the word culture. So maybe I should start with this. How do you define culture?
So first of all, culture is driven by leadership. Culture are to be the unspoken and spoken, written down and unwritten rules and behaviors of the department. What you allow and tolerate becomes the culture. If you tolerate a manager yelling at the employees, or watching the clock, or micromanaging them, or embarrassing them in public, that becomes part of the culture. See, culture is a defining whether or not someone's going to stay or not. People don't leave. People do. I say it all the time. And I found that in the county. People do not leave jobs. They leave people. They leave who they're working for. Most people love their jobs, but they leave the culture. And I told people, I did a presentation. I said, listen, you could take two people to make $80,000. You got an $80,000 person who walks in, there's coffee, there's donuts in the break room. Everybody's, good morning. Hey, Keith, how you doing? How's the camera? By the way, you did an excellent job on da 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 da. Boom, 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 boom. Then you got this. It's 8:05. And you're supposed to be at 8. It's 4:15. Where are you? Christmas Eve. When I first got here, I got a email at Christmas Eve at 5:15. It's 5:15. You're supposed to be here to 5:30. These are 80,000, 80,000. Which one feels like more money? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com.
toxic cultures are tolerated by the top, and the leadership has the ability to change that. Now, here's the thing about the difference between private and public. When I was in private, every single decision, everything that they do is all related to profit or loss. They will come in, a new CEO will come in and just slice 300 people because they're looking solely at numbers and whether or not they're making a profit. In public, everything we do, we're not trying to make money. Everything we do is for the residents. And I think that's where I found my mojo here in public, is because I'm realizing I'm affecting the homeless. I'm affecting economic development. I'm affecting the next project that's going to be built in West Palm Beach. I'm affecting whether or not somebody is going to be evicted. Everything that I'm affecting somebody's business is going to, giving them, you know, or small businesses, giving them opportunity. Someone transit, can they take a bus, a public transit, to get to their job because they can't afford? So it creates this avenue of feeling like what you do really matters. Now, here's the problem with that. In the public sector, people can be mundane or get to the point where they are sort of insulated. They're just doing a job. And so they can become insensitive to the need, because we're experiencing needs of people all the time. And you can, you know, if you've ever been to DMV or something like that and see how you're treated, not all of them. I'm not bashing, but sometimes when you go to public service, there's an expectation that they're not going to be friendly. They're not going to be courteous. It's going to take a long time. You're going to stand in a long line. And so I've told people, one of my first presentations, Keith, was operate like a Fortune 500 company, but think like a county. Operate with excellence. Time delivery, customer satisfaction, process improvement, using AI. Using the new technologies. But think like a county. I'm doing it for people. I'm changing lives. I'm improving my environment. You see what I'm saying? It's a difference.
Absolutely. I think it's something that's intrinsic with us as humans. You know, we want to contribute. I have a belief. I don't think anybody starts their first day at a new job thinking that this job is going to suck, it's going to be terrible, I'm going to hate working here. Now, plenty of people have those kind of jobs. Plenty of those people have bad attitudes. But I think on day one, that first day you're walking in, I think we're all fairly optimistic that it's going to be great. And then something happens to affect our attitude. I'm curious, what do you think is happening in the mindset of people from that, let's say, the day before they start to 20 years in when the mindset shifts? What are the differences there?
Oh, I've seen it. Oh, gosh. You know what it is? It's being smacked on the hand too many times, and you're like a puppy. You're like a gung-ho puppy, right? And then someone just, you do this and they smack your hand. You do this and they smack your hand. You made this comment, or you made this suggestion, or you gave this innovation, and they say no. And so people retreat. I remember in my role here, I asked specifically, let me develop a cross-departmental team focused on process improvement and efficiency. Because everybody was saying, we need to improve this process, we need to improve this. I said, oh, this is great. I was shut down in a heartbeat. And you know what the statement was? We don't want any other suggestions on how we need to improve. Because one, it's public record, and everybody's going to expect us to do them all.
Yeah.
So I came up with this mantra. If you want to lose weight, you have to be willing to get on the scale.
That's so true.
Think about it. It's kind of like you want to, you 260 and you know you want to get to 240, but you won't buy a scale, or you buy a scale, I'm not getting on it. I don't want to know. And you'd be surprised at how many people just don't want to know how bad they really are. They won't do it. I asked for an employee engagement survey. No. We don't want to know
how bad it is. Nope. I'm picturing like an ostrich with its head in the sand right now, you know? We don't want to know what's going on.
We don't want to know. They're just a bunch of whiners. They're just going to complain.
So I've heard it said, you touched on a few things. I've heard that said, you know, people don't quit jobs, they quit managers. I've also heard, you know, this topic of motivation, right? I mean, you know, if you're doing keynotes, I've heard you speak, you sound like a motivating guy. But I've also heard it said, you can't really as a leader, it's not so much about motivating people. It's more about not demotivating them. What do you have to say about the job of a manager and motivation versus not demotivating?
My whole thing is, listen, there are so many beaten down people who try to give an idea, who tried to make their voice known, who tried to be innovative, who had, like you said, they started with all these great, so they're demotivated already. I've got to motivate them. I've got to exude passion. I see any operational excellence role as facilitator, inspirer, motivator, data, using data, using benchmarking, using, root cause. You have to use every tool in the toolkit. But it starts with you have to exude. One thing that I try to do, and I have a critical eye. So I go to these conferences and I'm like, okay, that person has great data, but it's not believable because they're not exuding any passion. You see what I'm saying? You can have two people have data that they're presenting at a conference. And if they're not believable, you're just like, okay, I'm taking a set of notes. No, I truly believe this thing. I'm passionate about it. I'm like, no, I need to motivate you. So I need to get all the stuff, the baggage that somebody's put on you and get you to knock it off. When you leave the conference, you need to feel like, no, my manager has beat me down, or we don't have the right type of environment, but I'm going to be the change. If not, I'm leaving. Because I tell people this all the time. Listen, if you put most of us put 40 to 60 hours of our life into a week at a job. If you don't like it, if it's toxic, if your manager speaks negative and bad about you, sometimes your attitude, and I said your attitude, I've watched, because I'm like this, you intimidate a lot of people. And so your attitude has to be like, okay. So you get squashed, or you get marginalized, or you don't get invited to the table. And I kept the attitude. No one thought from where I'm at that I would be in the top four of the candidate for county administrator. No one. But you got to have that kind of attitude.
Well, and sometimes things don't go your way. You mentioned that you had ideas that you wanted to share. And, like a lot of people, right? If that first idea you have doesn't get picked up and you don't get celebrated for how wonderful your idea, or you don't get selected for that, how do you you're just from what I understand, you made it to the top four. Did they select someone else in that situation?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're at a point where you can be like, man, I give them everything. I'm not going to, they don't appreciate me. It's probably tempting to go there and to be frustrated. But I can see today you're not there. You picked yourself up. You've got this attitude of I've got this new opportunity. What do you say to people who've had that experience and then they just shut down?
You have to be resilient, and you have to look at every single opportunity as an opportunity. The person who got the job texted me that night. And I told the person, I said, I feel like I trained all year for a marathon and I still came in last place. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
So I was in that hole because I was good. I mean, and I was like process improvement, culture, blah, blah, blah. I was good. But he said, RT, you have no idea. You have no idea. He said, I want you right here with me. You have no idea what you have sparked. And then he said, your stock went way up. People that didn't even know you or your capabilities. I had people come and say, I didn't know you were, an engineer. I didn't know you had an executive MBA. I didn't know you had a PhD. Because where I was at, I was silenced. I did it anyway.
Yeah. Well, you used the word resilience just a minute ago, which I love. Resilience is one of my favorites because I think all of us, we all have these things that don't go right, things that don't happen. The other day, my car died. I had to call AAA and get my car towed while I was fixing issues from a flood at home. It was like one thing after another. And I just had that word popped into my head, resilience. Like, it is what it is. I just got to deal with it. And then I'm going to move forward. I'm curious, are there some lessons that you've had in life or some moments where you've built that resilience? Cause not everybody has it. How do you get that level of resilience?
I say this, I give all these examples in my book, Your Attitude is Your Breakthrough, because you got to have resilience. Your attitude, you don't know what you've been saved from. In every situation, you don't know what, when a door closes, it's for a reason. And it may be so another door will open. How many times have you been driving and somebody cut you off? And you're like, that really pissed you off. But then I had to think about it. My attitude, I said, you know what? But how many times have I was getting ready to miss my exit and I'm not missing that exit and I cut somebody off to get that exit? You know what I mean? I had to like, wait, why am I changing my attitude or changing my disposition because somebody just cut in front of me? Another one, how many times you got to the airport and you can't get through TSA, you can't get through security, and you're so frustrated, or you've seen someone who is so frustrated and so mad, but you think about it, that was just poor planning. And they're doing their job. And my attitude was like, well, what if they weren't doing their job and somebody got through that shouldn't get through and they're on your plane? So you begin to like, I got to change my attitude about when something doesn't go my way. What am I being saved from? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's all in your attitude. Everything happens for a reason and you don't have to fight every battle.
There's a couple of interesting lessons in there. You know, I love to talk about core values, and you talk about attitude and core values and
core values.
Touched on resilience. There's one that I'm a big fan of and hold dearly is just this idea of faith that, you know, sometimes there's a reason why certain things happen. I can hear you referring to that a bit as well. Another one that I guess is just me sharing a little lesson from my own experiences. There's been times as a leader and just as a human where I've had very emotional reactions, like, you know, call it that road rage moment, but maybe applied in a work situation. And I can tell you, there is never a time where I've had like a highly emotional in a negative way that I haven't regretted it later.
Yes.
You know, like it feels good in the moment to explode and to say that, but always in hindsight, I'm like, I didn't need to say that. I didn't need to do that.
Yep.
So I don't know.
You know, in a moment, you feel like you had it, you know, that you got some vindication from it, then you realize it is one piece. I talk about an event like that in my book where I say control, alt, delete. Control your emotions. Come up with an alternative approach or thinking and delete every negative thought about it. Don't let someone rent space in your head for free.
I like that, yeah.
You know? Because we replace stuff over and over again. So it's interesting that we're talking about all this. And, you know, it's funny because I always have to say, you know what? It ties to performance management. Some people don't see it. It's all ties to, because this is, how do people show up? They bring all of that stuff to work. So if you can change their attitude or how, when they come up against opposition, they get shut down or something happened at work or they get cut off coming to work or the kids, you know, got in a fight at school, all that translates into how they're going to perform at work. And sometimes we just see them as a contributor. We just want them to get their work done. And we're not seeing them as human. And sometimes we got to take a step back and say, how's my team doing? Sometimes you got to take them, you got to bring them all in all together and say, so how's everybody doing? How's everybody, you know, what's going on in your life? You got to show that, you know, people always say, you know, people don't care how much you know, they want to know how much you care. They really do. They want to know, do you really see them as a person?
Keith, tell us, you mentioned this book a little bit. Tell us just a little bit about why you decided to write it and the job to be done of the book itself.
The name of the book is Your Attitude is Your Breakthrough. Reason why I say that is because when I was 18 years old and I got a scholarship to Boston University and I packed my father's army trunk and with everything that I owned from Youngstown, Ohio, And I got on a Greyhound bus, never been to Massachusetts before in my life. 18 years old, just turned 18. And my attitude was, I'm not going back. There's a lot of people don't get out of Youngstown, Ohio. I'm not, if I go back, I'm going back as an engineer and to help. So I, when I got to financial aid and I didn't have enough, I thought my scholarship covered everything and I didn't have enough. Or I got there and they didn't have enough dorms. They were overfilled. So they put me in a travel lodge for the first 2 to 3 weeks. My attitude, did I break down? You know, at 18 years old, when I got to my engineering class and the engineering professor said, look to your left, look to your right. One of you is not going to be here next semester. My attitude was like, that's not going to be me. When I got to my engineering class and they said, most engineers never finish in 4 years. I said, that's not going to be me. So it was just constant attitude. But my attitude changed my behavior. It's all in how you reposition yourself. Being resilient against every single thing that comes up against you. And so now I take that into the workplace and I tell folks, listen, when I'm doing training and change management, I say change leadership. Before I can get to Lean Six Sigma and process improvement and forming a team, I talk to them about the attitude. I talk to them about how can we break down some of the, but we've always done it this way. Mentalities. So
when you're working in this lane of performance management, maybe you could describe a little bit about what you mean by performance management. And when you're going into a different group, let's say breaking down silos, what's your attitude or approach to finding that foothold in those organizations where maybe the attitude isn't quite right or it needs to be shifted a little bit? How do you develop that openness?
Right. So I do a great deal of education and training. So I'll give you an example. I got a call, said, can you help the county attorneys? So we have at least about maybe 50 to 60 county attorneys. They had never done the team building or they had never done a SWOT analysis. Can you help us set our strategy? So I went in. I said, this is what I need. I need 3 hours. I said, and some coffee and some donuts. That's all I need. I said, okay, I educate them on their strategy. And I said, you need a vision, mission, goals, and objectives. But before we go there, I want to break you guys off into groups. And I want you to come up with the strengths of this department, the weaknesses of this department, the opportunities, and the threats. And I don't want you to focus on the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats of just how you perform what you do. I want you to come up with the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats of what's going on in this environment. So you start to get stuff like, we don't talk to each other. We silently compete. We don't think there's enough diversity. We don't think there's enough training. We don't think there's enough accolades. I'm a younger consultant, so I want constant feedback. Well, I'm a more seasoned account attorney. I don't need any feedback. All of that came out in the session. And so the head is like, I had no idea. We want you to bring back the ping pong tournament. Little stuff like that. When you open the playground for everybody to play, it completely changes the dynamic. And it's very, the biggest problem is being intentional about it. It's just that people are so busy doing their work. They don't take time to pause and be intentional about, well, what is our strategy? What is our strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats? What are the weaknesses of what we do? So I've done this in at least about a third to a half of the different departments. And it just opened them up. And they said, we don't work as a team. But we're... So some of the departments are very large and they have multiple divisions. Found out that none of the people in the different divisions, they talk to each other. Our number one, when I did a SWOT analysis of the entire county, the number one weakness is we operate in silos.
Silos, yeah.
Silos was huge. We're still working through that. So I created 7 strategic priorities for the county. And then I asked the board, can I create a cross-departmental team for each strategic priority? Because you got to look at it this way. You got 40 different departments. You'd be surprised how many departments in their own way are doing something related to economic development or housing and homelessness or public safety. And they weren't talking to each other.
I want to pick up on something. I want to drill down on something that you mentioned right there. You've talked a little bit about like individual contributor versus manager and leader, and there's a lot here. But I've heard you say something a couple of times where basically the job to be done wasn't necessarily handed to you. Like I think that you saw something that you thought needed to be done. You took that tube. You said, "Hey, here's something I see needs to be done." And you basically, maybe asked for permission or authority to go and do that across silos. Explain that a little bit, because I think that's a key part of this spark concept that I think hopefully is part of people's attitudes, is to have the guts to do that.
Yeah. One, you do have to have guts to do it. And it was so interesting that so much that I've done without permission and made it such a success that everybody wants to take credit for. And then there's some things that you do. You know, you heard the old montage, ask for forgiveness versus permission. I don't advocate that for everybody, but I'll give you some examples. I realized that when I started working with the department's attitudes were really, really bad. Morale was bad. The knowledge of what's capable didn't exist. So I said, I'm going to create, using our Channel 20, which is our own station, I'm going to create Feed Your Mind. Feed Your Mind is 11:30 to 1 every 2 weeks. And I brought in, for instance, if you were right here in Florida, I would say, I'm having our guest for today is Keith Norris, who is going to showcase you KPI Fire on how key performance measures can change your workplace. And so I put out a schedule for every month and was published. It was before COVID, they were all in a conference room. People could sign up for it and come to the conference room. After COVID, I turned to virtual and got even wider, because now it's broadcast live to all employees. But every topic I wanted to change somebody's attitude or mind in, one title, Got Metrics. What is your strategy? Intro to Lean Six Sigma. You see what I'm saying? I'm bringing ideas so people can hear. Because you think of, these are employees who this is all they know. I couldn't even introduce the concepts of Lean Six Sigma or a black belt, or they don't know what that is. I remember having the title. My title says Lean Six Sigma Black Belt. To this day, majority of people think I have an actual black belt.
That you're
rumor. Somebody just said rumor has it that you got your black belt. It's like I really wanted a karate black belt. It's continuous process improvement, man. You see what I'm saying?
Some people know the nunchucks, but, you know, put a five wise or a fishbone in your head and you get dangerous.
You get dangerous. It's like five wise, fishbone.
I want to come back to this topic of metrics. How do you adjust the mindset from metrics that feel punitive or like, hey, you're doing good enough, you're not doing good enough, to metrics that are more of a feedback mechanism to use as a tool? How do you approach that with folks in your organization?
It has taken quite a bit of training and people not being ostracized for not performing, because it was a transition, because everybody was, you know, wanting to look good. And so I had to educate them on, and this is one of the ways I won them over. I showed the part how, so the my heart, our whole metric system is built on the traffic light, okay? Red, green, and yellow. So obviously, and so you can look dead at this scorecard. And if you see, so they all have a scorecard. So if you see all reds for each quarter, that's something to key in on, right? But here's the thing, I've shown them how to use that to their advantage, because in some cases, that clearly shows that they need more resources. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so it causes, like, metrics can work for you. It's using data to get better, to get on a scale, but also get more resources to maintain the parts, you know, that type of thing.
I think I love the red, yellow, green. I think that the red, yellow, green is something that a lot of people see, But I also think that's one of those things that you have to define as part of leadership, like what the colors mean. Like in some organizations, red might mean, hey, this person's getting fired next quarter, right?
Yes.
And so I think that just explaining to what people mean by red, yellow, green is an important part of like a performance management system, because red, yellow, and green on their own, they're just colors. We've all learned right. to drive. Adding some context to those. So is that something that you help people understand what they're actually communicating with those metric colors when it comes to things like?
Yes, I was looking for the training part. But so we start off by explaining, like I said, I do tons of education and training. But I have a graphic that clearly shows red means this, green means this, yellow means this. And how do you actually achieve those? I'm a true proponent in any implementation, you have to do education and training constantly, because the people change. So once they got the concept, because when I first came on board, they said, oh, we got metrics. They had, in some departments, they had metrics, but they had no targets. They weren't shooting for anything. So the red, green, and yellow, they turn red, green, and yellow based on your number versus where you want to be. So if your target is 95% and you are 88, you're going to be red. But if you don't ever set a target, you're going to always look good. And some of them is like, oh, we're 88%. Okay, well, is that good? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I had to actually educate, you know, it's my whole toolkit. I had to educate them on benchmarks. Well, it's 88% on-time delivery Miami-Dade does, or Broward does, or Orlando.
I think that's an interesting part of performance management generally that I see in my role in KPI Fire is that decision around what metrics to track. I mean, you know, kind of flippantly, I'll say it's like a game where we get to decide the rules. You know, you can choose which metrics you want to track. I'm curious if you have some favorite metrics in like things that you've discovered, maybe around employee engagement or attitude, or maybe it's on-time delivery, but are there some metrics that you've found that are maybe a little bit different or unique, or maybe a unique discovery to Palm Beach County that are just good metrics for showing progress on a particular dimension?
You know, that's an interesting question. It's so dynamic. When I went to East Department, I asked them one question. How do you know you're performing? Good, bad, or indifferent?
I like that.
How do you know? And the first answer I got, resounding, which made me realize there was a lot of work to be done, is they said, based on the amount of commissioner calls I get, how many times, you know, because the commissioners hear from the residents, and then the commissioners then call the departments and say, this happened, what happened, this happened, what happened. And so it's all this constant firefighting to police and commissioners. I'm like, no, that's too late. I said, you need to know. If you're managing your department, you need to know, is your department performing? And so that triggered. It's like, okay. So they said, so now we're putting in measures. And the ones that try to shy away from the hard ones, I said, no, I think you need this measure. Because, well, we don't control that. I'm like, listen, but your whole department is built on reducing homelessness. I know you can't control everything, but you need to at least know whether or not the amount of homeless went down from this year to 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, we don't, there's so many factors. I'm like, hey, but hopefully you're making some impact. So you need to see if there's a trend. We have those conversations. I'll give you an example. Palm Beach County has increased in amount of visitors. We have like 9 million visitors coming every year. Everybody loves our beaches and our parks. What does that mean? And when you begin to look at metrics, there's certain times of the year where it's a peak, right? Now think about it, because if you're not in park and recreations, you're not really thinking about what does that do to the bathroom? What does that do to the rental of pavilions? What does that do to crime in the parks? So when I look at their metrics, I remember seeing during peak times where all these visitors are here and in the summer and all that, their bathrooms and maintenance problems are in the red. Bathrooms are in the red. You know, all these things are in the red. And so the question is, do we give them more people? And I remember having a conversation during a budget meeting because somebody said, well, I may be okay with 80%. So then you begin to question, like, do I want to pay the extra to get at 95%? Or am I willing to take the L, the loss, with people complaining and only fund enough to get us at 80%? But at least now we're making decisions, budget decisions based off of data, based off of data. I remember this last budget season, Park and Recreations came in and said, we need more park rangers and we need more sheriffs in the parks because the crime, if you showed the number of crimes, they had increased. So the conversation is, okay, do we get you more park rangers or do we add money for you to pay for sheriff's deterrence or sheriff folks. What's great about that conversation is park rangers have no authority but to tell you to move or to tell you, you know. And so quickly the residents realize, oh, you have no authority. You know, go, you know, get out of here type of thing. But sheriffs cost a lot more. So from the way this translates into the budget is, do I pay for 10 more park rangers? Or do I pay for two PBSO sheriffs that can sit in their cars all day? You see where you begin to use data to make decisions?
Yeah, data-driven decision-making. And you can, I mean, from that, you can follow along how knowing some structured problem-solving methods and understanding how X's and Y's interact and that sort of thing can benefit solving all kinds of problems from private sector to public sector.
And I'll just end with this really quick. You're also up against someone who's always just added park rangers. You see what I'm saying? So if they've always done it this way, I'm sitting in a room with my, and maybe one of the only ones is thinking out of the box saying, but what if we did it differently? So I'm also up against that with someone that is not thinking, one sheriff can take the, can be more of a deterrent than five park rangers.
So Keith, let me ask you this. Is there some advice that you might give somebody who's working in an organization, public or private? Maybe they feel a little bit beat down, a little bit disengaged. They've had good ideas in the past, but they're listening to, you know, this podcast and hearing you talk about attitude. Are there some things about attitude that you would want to leave with people to help them feel that desire to try one more time?
Well, the easy part is the academic side. Vision, mission, objectives, putting a new system, that type of thing. The culture slash attitude requires intentionality. It requires you being an ambassador. It requires you being the change that you want to see and being resilient. That, you know, and I tell those people, unfortunately, sometimes it requires for you to either wait out the leadership or leave because the environment is set by the leadership. And if you're constantly shutting down and they're not going anywhere, you don't see any signs of them going anywhere. You can try to be a change. You can try to, but it's going to have some effect because you can win ambassadors over and just sort of create an environment around you. But sometimes you have to leave to thrive. You have to leave to thrive. And the goal should be to thrive. It should be to, when I go to work, I love my job, but I also love the environment. And I love the people I work with. And if you can't see that long term, you need to. And it's interesting, Keith, the way this is changing in recruiting. When you go for another job, and most people who are in toxic environments, they're always looking. They have to begin to ask questions like, so what? How do you reward performance? What's the culture like? How do people get along? Do you have any examples of a newsletter where you're actually showcasing? People have to be on the interviewing side asking the right questions because there's a meme that I include in my presentation that your manager is the biggest contributor to your mental health. More so than your therapist, more so than your church, whatever, your manager. That manager can make your life a living hell. And if you go into that and you stay in that, it's your fault at this point. So I would leave people with, listen, you try to be the chain, you try to wait it out, you try to make a dent, But if you can't see anything at the light of the tunnel after you've done all that and you had the right attitude, you got to find, you have to begin to find the right place where you will thrive.
And how do you know if you're in the right place where you can thrive? Like you've shared a couple of examples of ideas that you had that you took to get some, you know, executive support, you might say, to do some, to make some change. Where did you take those ideas and what sort of advice might you give to others? Like, hey, if you have an idea, what could you do with it?
Yeah. It's so funny, Keith. I mean, it's like you ever go to a cocktail party or a networking session or a conference, or you go into a room, or you go to a setting, and it just feels, I'll put it on both sides, it just feels good. It just feels great. Or you go and it just feels awkward, or it feels like you're being shunned, or it feels like no one's looking you in the face, or it feels like no one, your words are, don't matter. You know, people know.
You know.
You've ever gone to a cookout, you ever gone to a family function, we are wound that way. We're relational. You know, same with the, and sometimes we turn it off when it comes to our workplace. Like, you know when people don't like you. You know when people feel threatened by you. You know when they don't want to receive, they like, there's so many people who are so insecure that your aura irritates them. And you know that. That's what, you know, so it's kind of hard to put into words, but I guarantee you, anybody's listening to this, just be more cognitive of what you walk into and see. And the problem is we think we can change a vibe. No, you know, that's why I put up good vibes only, positive vibes only. As soon as I walk into a situation and I'm not feeling it, you got to get out of there. And it's the same with a job. It's like, start looking day one. You know, if you feel like you can change it and you can get some ambassadors on your side, good. But if you don't see no insight, it's time to look. Because here, life is short. You need to enjoy as much time at work as you do at home. And I have one slide that I tell people, listen, if you're living for 5 o'clock, weekends or vacations, then you've pretty much given the whole rest of your life away. You see what I'm saying? Some people, I've seen people here in the county, they can't wait till 5 o'clock come, vacation comes, or the weekends, and they just tolerate
the rest. Well, Keith, I got a little section here called the rapid fire. These are just a few kind of quick questions, one word, one phrase. We'll just run through these. The most important job of a leader is to blank.
Develop people.
I love it. Is there a book that you like or recommend that folks might pick up?
I started with John Maxwell's very small book, Attitude 101.
Attitude 101.
I read this many years ago. John Maxwell's Attitude 101.
That's great. John Maxwell is a great author. Do you have a favorite question that you like to use in this performance management, or maybe a few questions that you find yourself asking a lot that help you get it good information?
Yes. The thing that opened up everything, I think, for me was, how do you know? How do you know you're doing a good job? How do you know you're performing? That takes you right into attitude. What their attitude is, metrics, whether or not they use data or whether or not it's a feel good. So that's my number one question. How do you know you are performing? And if you don't know it, then are you willing to get on the scale?
Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been a real pleasure. We appreciate your time and your experience. And for any of our listeners, if you'd like to suggest a guest or ask a question, go ahead and comment. That always helps with the the stats is to comment on the post. You can reach out to me, Keith Norris, on LinkedIn. You can find Keith Klinkscale on LinkedIn also. And this concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. Until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.